Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and since Natasha just called in sick and Vicky's on the road again, it'll just be me, but thrilled to be here with Peter Gross and Dr. Ray Wynn Grant, co-host of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, Protecting the Wild.
Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom is presented by Mutual of Omaha.
You can see their Emmy-nominated television show Saturday mornings on NBC, or watch it on Peacock, Amazon Prime, YouTube. So many outlets, you have no excuse not to watch it. Peter Gross, among other things, is a wildlife expert, licensed animal educator, and 40-year veteran of the show, going back to the original Wild Kingdom program that so many of us grew up on. Dr. Wynn Grant is a wildlife ecologist specializing in carnivore-human interactions, who also focuses on expanding science communications, accessibility, and sustainability. A National Geographic Research Fellow and author, she joined the show in 2023. Show's also getting saltier since the original, when I used to watch Merlin Perkins directing Jim Fowler to rescue anacondas into burlap bags, but they also got underwater. Recent episodes, along with the focus on terrestrial conservation, have gone below the surface to focus on aquatic animals, gray whales, and a favorite of Natasha's and mine, kelp forests. Before we get into the wonders and challenges of the Wild Kingdom, let me ask you each, how did you first encounter the ocean?
That's such a good question. And I think that the honest answer is that I grew up in a coastal place. I was born in San Francisco. And so there is a lot of ocean all around that city. However, as an urban kid, we didn't venture to the coastline. You know, we didn't recreate there and certainly didn't get in the water. So I originate from a place surrounded by ocean, a place where whales, you know, drift by every single day. But the first time that I got into the deep ocean with my full body, believe it or not, was on season one of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, where we were doing some shark stories. And I was in my 30s by then, my late 30s, and it was monumental.
Wow, we're going to have to come back to that. I love what I call shark-enhanced, not-infested waters. Peter, when did you first get in the ocean?
Well, mine was a little bit earlier. I was raised in the Dutchess County, which was a good distance from the nearest ocean, and had the occasion to make a trip as a teenager across the west coast of the Columbia River and saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time, where the Columbia meets the Pacific, where Lewis and Clark landed, and was reading the history of what it took for them to get there, and looked out at the expanse of this ocean for the first time in my life, sort of looking into infinity, knowing that 70% of the planet is covered with ocean's waters, and had it for the first time, salt water laughing at my feet, and watching people coming and going by boat, and said to, at this point, decided, this is something I have to learn to do very soon. So from that point on, I've become more involved in scuba and snorkel and sailing. And so much of my life is spent in and under the ocean, thanks to Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
So let me continue with you in terms of your career path that got you to Mutual of Omaha's.
Well, after I spent a short time in Silver Mine College in Connecticut, and then left, and at that time, the draft was in effect. So I ended up spending time in doing a construction battalion, building roads and hospitals near Da Nang. And then upon returning, I immediately went to school for animal husbandry and behavior. Then that progressed into working for a park where I became part of the American Zoo Association. And at the time, I was most interested in designing a place for animals to be that didn't involve bars or cages, and was fortunate enough to be able to have a display where people were caged in 40-person Colorado river rafts, and the animals were all loose on islands. And from that point on, my career just grew and grew.
Ray, we've got you as a child in San Francisco, unconnected to the ocean. And then you go on to what?
Well, my family didn't live in San Francisco long. We moved around the United States, living in different cities. And it was a wonderful kind of city-based, like I said, urban upbringing through being a teenager. But the real kicker that I love to talk about and still just seems so surreal to me is that from a very young age, I knew that I wanted to be a nature show host. That was the only career I have ever wanted since as far back as I can remember. I was probably 5 or 6 when I first said it. And it took me through elementary school and middle school and high school. And even when I entered college and I had my first meeting with an advisor, I said, okay, great. I don't know what I want to major in, but I'd like to become a nature show host. So what do you think? And that was because as a kid, I watched a lot of nature shows. So, you know, my advisor said, I don't really know how you can be a nature show host, but they know environmental science. And so why don't you try that out? And it was that year that I really began to understand, like, okay, I'm not sure if I'll ever make it to TV, but I can do all of the things that a nature show host is doing if I become a wildlife ecologist. It was 2003 when I started that work as a student, and I have been doing wildlife ecology in academia and the nonprofit space literally ever since.
Peter, you've been with the show a long time. How'd you first get onto the show?
Well, it's interesting. I was having success with the breeding of endangered species, and we happened to have the largest litter of tigers ever born. And ideally, you do not want to have to hand raise animals, but if the parents can't take care of them, sometimes you have to intercede and bottle raise them. Well, the mother of this large group of cubs, whom I had hand raised 5 years earlier, produced 7. And she obviously was not going to be able to take care of them, and they weren't all getting the necessary colostrum. So she let me crawl into her denning area, rotate the cubs so they could also nurse, get the colostrum. And someone took a picture, and to give you an idea how long ago this was, it went on the wire. And we then got a call from the people in the Tonight Show wanting to meet the world's largest litter of tigers. And the conversation was, when they're strong enough, it's close, as long as I can talk about the plight of tigers and tigers conservation. So off we went. And who was there but Jim Fowler from Wild Kingdom? And it went well. And at the end of the show, we sat in the green room and chatted a little bit. And he said, Mr. Perkins is thinking about retiring. We're not really looking for an actor. We're looking for someone with conservation experience. Would you be interested? And I said, let me think for about 3 seconds.
Right.
And then, and we'll just say from that point, the rest is history. In 1985, I started doing shows with him. And the very first show was with alligators in Louisiana. And then I cut my teeth in a cage in Australia where they were testing shark repellent and chainmail shark suits and studying white shark behavior.
Awesome. And so started with alligators. I'm sure someone on the set must have said, what a crock. But skipping down a generation, what was your thesis, your PhD thesis?
I just really latched onto wildlife ecology, and my first research project was on zebras in East Africa. And I went through, you know, an undergraduate thesis, master's degree, and loved it so much. I was like, well, more school must be the answer. And so I pursued a PhD, honestly, not because I thought to myself, like, I want to be Dr. Wynn Grant, but because I thought to myself, this is still the only way I know how to be outside and to help wild animals. That's how it's accessible to me. And so my PhD was focused on the ecology of black bears in a ecosystem where they had been extirpated. So I studied a population of black bears in western Nevada, close to the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And the state of Nevada had not had a black bear population in you know, maybe more than 100 years until the early 2000s when they started slowly coming back from California, you know, crossing the Sierra Nevada mountains and coming back in. And by the time I was engaged with the project in 2010, there were about like between 200 and 300 black bears in the entire state of Nevada. So barely any compared to California that had 40,000 black bears.
Right, but we have to wait on Oregon to give us our wild wolves again.
You know, there's a lot going on in the West when it comes to carnivores and predators. So I was studying, you know, their movement with so much habitat to choose from. Where were black bears going and why? You know, why were they picking different habitat? How were they recolonizing this historic space? And the idea was to learn about these bears, but also to learn about what we might expect in other places around the world where there might be animals that are finally doing better, finally returning to a landscape. You know, conservation is working and they're recolonizing that habitat. And it was amazing. It was magical. And here is where science communication came in. Because of the amazing intersection of me and my identity as, you know, at that point, like a 25-year-old urban black woman studying this animal, we also had the invention of social media was really hitting right then, right around the time that I was getting in the field with bears.
Let me guess, you were an Ursine influencer.
I was early on, you know, one of the only biologists with a presence and a following on social media because of a number of factors, you know, because scientists were doing science communication in very traditional ways at the time, because of the project I was working on, because of my identity. I mean, a lot of these things came together and it made me really happy because I was reaching audiences that were very much like me. Most of my followers were not scientists. They were like young black and brown women like me who are saying like, wow, wait, we do this very, you know, like I just have never been included in this field. And my science communication really took off because I found a separate purpose, you know, which was to educate communities that have often been left out of environmental conversations. And like all the wildlife hosts that I had watched growing up, I was having fun doing it, right? Like it was work, but it was purposeful and it was a blast and it was making positive impact on people and on wild animals. I did that for years. And in 2022, Wild Kingdom came knocking and they said, oh, you may have heard of our show, which I obviously had. And they said, we are doing a pilot season, but we need a guest for each episode. Will you be the guest for the bear episode? And I said, are you kidding? I would do anything you say. This is, you know, a dream come true to be a guest on Wild Kingdom. And I was brought on and Peter and I spent several days in the Pacific Northwest with this beautiful story of bears that were harmed, literally burned in a wildfire. Bear cubs whose paws got burned as they were trying to escape the fire, but who were found and rehabilitated. And on our episode, we released them back into the wild because they were ready to be wild again. A year later, when they had the deal with NBC to fully bring back Wild Kingdom to broadcast, I was invited to co-host with Peter, and it was absolutely a dream come true. I almost dropped the phone when I got the call.
Great. You're out with bears. You're very familiar with bears. And now you're going in the water with sharks. What was that episode? What was that all about?
I'm happy to say that we have filmed several shark episodes. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, if a person's unfamiliar with sharks, they kind of think it's one thing, you know, like a shark is a shark is a shark. But we have done two, if not three shark episodes because there are so many ecosystems, there are so many stories, there are so many species, there are so many conservation issues that are different. And visually, getting underwater with these sharks is awesome. So the first time that we filmed with sharks, Peter and I were on the central coast of California and we were on the beach. And we got in kayaks, we're in wetsuits, knowing that there's a good chance we would topple into the water, which I did. And we got in our kayaks and we got out past the waves and we're in the Pacific. And believe it or not, we were not very far from shore before the drone pilot above us was able to say, oh, you got a great white shark 40 feet to your right. And there I was with Peter, who has, you know, truly been underwater with great white sharks. But there I was, very green. You know, I have studied carnivores. I've studied predators for 20 years. But I had never been in the water with them. And I had never seen a shark. And I had never thought that I would be the kind of person to be eventually inches from one. And Peter and I were kayaking, and this juvenile great white shark that was, you know, 8 or 9 feet long was just coming up and looking at us. And if you watch this episode, Peter's keeping his cool and he's doing his job by saying, "Oh my gosh, look at this. Here it is. And I can see the dorsal fin." He's describing the anatomy of the shark and he's communicating the science. Meanwhile, what you hear from me is hooting and hollering and shrieking and screaming because I'm so excited and also a little bit afraid because we are so close to the shark. And it's a magical moment for me because it's my first time and it's our first time together. But the main point that we try to make, and I think we succeed in making in all of our shark episodes, is that they are afraid of us. They are not a threat to people. And this really misunderstanding that humans have about sharks being extremely dangerous is wrong. You know, when we're in the water, we're totally in their habitat. But even when we're there, they just want to check us out and they don't want to hurt us.
This is David Helvard for Blue Frontier, the voice for ocean action for over 20 years. This year, with public broadcasting under attack, we continue providing free programming to a number of community radio stations with our Rising Tide Ocean podcast. Rising Tide brings diverse voices of our ocean world to audiences on air and online. Your contribution this Giving Tuesday will help keep this and our other projects afloat. So thank you for your help and best wishes from the crew at Blue Frontier. So let me ask you both, I mean, what's happened with wildlife since Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom first broadcast in 1963? You know, along with climate change, what's happening with our wildlife and our biodiversity is a genuine crisis. How do you see it? How do you approach it? And you've got some real legacy with the program that can address these issues.
Well, it's interesting. I remember growing up watching the show, and Marlon Perkins would be on camera with an eagle on his glove that had been rehabilitated, talking about the effects of DDT on our birds of prey and the peregrine falcon, how they were disappearing, and how some places the rivers in the middle of our country were so polluted they would actually catch fire. And the sad stories that they would tell us and then make recommendations about how we as viewers could do something to participate and help save wildlife. But we've always had serious problems with wildlife. It seems now that the problems we have can be insurmountable. But as I look back now, the alligators I talked about earlier are off the endangered species list. The bald eagle, our national bird, is off. The black-footed ferret, which was thought to have been completely extinct, which we did a show on, which is on Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, Protecting the Wild, talks about it was rediscovered and then reintroduced. So there are a fair number of animals that are success stories. When I talk to young people or at universities, I'd like to point out the number of things at the time that we thought could not be solved, and the species that were destined to become extinct. And due to positive conservation programs, which is really what we focus an awful lot on our show, is successful conservation programs to sort of create hope for the next generation. We hope to connect the next generation so they'll become involved with conservation and not dwell too much on gloom and doom. Yes, indeed, we do have serious problems and we have huge problems that need to be solved. But I also think as often as we can, we point out these pockets of restoration and successes, and that'll create hope for people. So I think it's as important that we as Mutual of Omaha on Wild Kingdom point out each success we can, and then also the problem and hopefully solutions of what each one of us can do to help to solve them.
Sure. And I guess what you do pretty beautifully is balance that sense of wonder and warning. And I know, Ray, you're very interested in making sure the production facility itself is sustainable. And you know, how do you approach the work that you're not interfering with the behavior of the wildlife itself, and that you're doing it in a way that reflects your values?
You know, this is something that Peter and I are both very passionate about. We talk about all the time because you're right. It is smaller kind of behind the scenes things like, are we bringing single use plastic to set, you know, in our water bottles, or are we eating out of styrofoam when we're on the road? Those things are something that Peter and I really stand up for all the time. But additionally, I think that any of us in, you know, wildlife media have probably had bad experiences where we've seen people do things that are harmful. You know, I've been a part of productions before my Wild Kingdom days where I've noticed camera operators like kind of doing anything to get the shot, right? Which might be manipulating the environment, maybe like luring an animal with bait or a scent, you know, in order to get in the shot, or being just slightly too close to an animal. And this is something that we take so seriously that sometimes I would say Peter and I are spending a lot of time trying to demonstrate to our audience how they should view wildlife. So you will see us with our binoculars. You will see us at such distances from the animal that we're viewing if it's wild that, you know, sometimes the camera operator might have a hard time getting us in the shot with the animal, right? So you'll see two different ones. We filmed an episode in season 2 of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom Protecting the Wild in the subarctic. So we were in the Hudson Bay in Canada, where there are polar bears in the summertime. And we really had to have like several meetings with our camera crew to discuss how close will our drone get to the polar bears. I think that most wildlife programs have evolved to use different technologies, you know, camera traps, drones from a significant distance. Peter often really acknowledges what he has seen in his years from close-up shots to now like using these lenses that can zoom in so far that you're getting the same effect. We're really proud of Wild Kingdom. We're so, so proud that we can really stand by our production to say we have the biology, we have the ecology, we have the animal welfare in check. And we know that we're able to tell these stories without infringing on the animals' habits.
One of our goals is to be able to show natural wildlife behavior. Before the technology was here, when a shot was made with a helicopter in the distance when you need an aerial shot, now you have a very quiet drone that captures this animal in the distance, maybe at a watering hole. Back when we first started working with scientists and biologists, the manner in which they would check animals would be to catch them with a net or sometimes tranquilize them on the run. What we do now is it's so removed from the animal that we're so proud of the fact that the behavior you'll see is what the animal is doing, oftentimes not even knowing it's being filmed.
These are amazing stories, and the approach that you're talking about of sort of being less invasive, taking it slower actually may get you to see more. And I guess that's one of the lessons is not jumping in on the animals, but standing back and letting them see how they behave.
Absolutely. And we're fortunate that Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom Protecting the Wild, this amazing show that we're working on, is focused on wild animals and stories of conservation. But we also focus on the people who are doing the conservation. You know, so Peter and I are certainly conservationists, but we are not working on one particular project that's on camera. We visit these projects and we're interacting with and talking to the people who are in charge. And often that comes with the bonus of being able to be hands-on with the animal. So whether we are in a breeding facility, whether we're working with, you know, wildlife that are injured and being rehabilitated, we usually luck out and we are with an expert that is able to show the camera this animal or get us very close somehow. And that is one of the just amazing bonuses personally of doing the show, is that every single episode we do, which is there are 26 episodes per season, so it's a lot of work that we're doing, we are learning something new about a new species. I mean, even though I've done all of this school, I'm learning about animals I never thought I'd interact with just by being a co-host of this show.
Now, we're in a moment where science is under attack, NOAA's being defunded. The president of the United States calls climate change a hoax. I mean, we're in a tough time for science communications. And How do you keep on keeping on in this environment? How good are you, Ray, since you're the science communications?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that things that are objective have become politicized, right? I, as a scientist with very formal and kind of traditional training, we are always taught that science is neutral, right? The answer is the answer. It's the pursuit of truth is science. And so it's been suggested that science actually isn't neutral, that it is political and partisan. There are people who want to be loyal to their political party and then believe that science is against them. It also means that fewer people feel welcome in science and to be scientists, right? So, you know, in my advocacy to make sure that all folks are welcome and have belonging and are included in scientific careers, I'm mostly doing that work for underrepresented and historically oppressed groups like Black folks. But I also believe that everyone, even people from across the aisle politically, belong in science and should be empowered in science and should be welcome and included in science because it should be apolitical. It should be the safe space where we're just looking for the answers. I am hopeful. I really am. I'm an eternal optimist. I truly believe that science will persevere. But I mean, you know, again, not to come off as toxically optimistic, but I think every human on this planet wants humans on this planet to persist. And the only way that human beings can persist on this planet is if we pull it together and heal the environment. So even though we might be going about it in different ways, at the end of the day, I truly believe that we can all agree on the fact that we want our kids to live on a healthy, thriving planet, that we want our grandchildren and the future of our family members to live in a safe and beautiful world. And that's what keeps me going. I know that there's so much we can agree on, and a lot of it is scientific.
Peter Gross and Dr. Ray Wynn Grant, co-host of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, Protecting the Wild. Thank you for joining me today on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helbart and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.